Welcome to Carnivores Don't Get Sunburned, hosted by Carrie Mann. Dive into the extraordinary journey of rediscovering optimal health through the carnivore diet. Here, we share powerful transformations from reversing chronic illnesses to achieving peak human potential. Each episode, we'll explore the real stories of those who've turned their lives around, embracing a diet that's as natural as the sun. Stay tuned as we uncover the science, the success stories, and the secrets to thriving on this ancestral diet. Plus, don't miss our exciting documentary highlights featuring a diverse range of carnivore champions. Ready to challenge the conventional? Let's get started.
The following is one part of a four-part series with Dr. Sean Baker on the carnivore diet, covering several different topics. Be sure to visit rivero.com. Dr. Baker's doing some incredible work over there. Now let's get started. This is arguing the carnivore diet. So I've got a few arguments. Why can't you just eat in moderation?
Yeah, that's a really common question, because there are people out there that will see these success stories and they'll say, well, the only reason she put her autoimmune disease into remission or lost her depression is because she lost weight. And you can do that on any diet. And you certainly can lose weight on really any diet, quite honestly. And certainly, I think a diet where you get rid of all this ultra processed garbage is clearly beneficial for many people. And many people, that's all they need. I don't think everybody needs to go carnivore. However, and you know this as well as I do, there are people that will say, look, I was eating a balanced whole food, clean diet, free of junk food, free of sugary stuff, free of oils, and yet my health was still sick. But when I got rid of the healthy fruits and vegetables, my health got better. I mean, you just can't deny that's happening. And so what the mechanism by which that is, we can debate about, but there's no debate in my mind that it clearly does occur. Now, why that is, you know, maybe it's the modern food environment. Maybe the guts are so wrecked that they can't tolerate things that maybe 100 years ago would have been tolerated. Doesn't matter the reason why. The only thing that matters is it works. And most people that have come to carnivore have already tried all of those things. They've already tried the balanced diet, the moderation, and it didn't work for them. I mean, I just interviewed a gal with something called CIDP, chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, a nurse, vegan, grew her own vegetables, whole food diet. You know, she tried everything, didn't eat garbage, only carnivore helped her. So, you know, it is what it is. I mean, I wish, you know, that were true, that everybody could just eat a regular healthy diet with balanced diet and it would be fine, but it doesn't work for a lot of people. In fact, for many people, it doesn't work at all.
The next question I have, I get this all the time. You can't eat only meat. You're going to have a heart attack. You're going to clog your arteries. What about cholesterol?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest criticism of this and any low carb diet, is that sometimes we see people where the cholesterol goes up, and we have a pretty good handle on why that's occurring now. I think hats off to Dave Feldman and others that have shown that this lipid energy model has been demonstrated over and over again. There's a number of scientific papers that shows that, is that the reason LDL cholesterol goes up in people on low carb diets is because of higher trafficking of energy in the liver in the form of fat. Because we're lean and we're not metabolically unhealthy. And that's a very different situation to the standard American who is obese, overweight, pre-diabetic, stuffed full of energy, and that energy has nowhere to go. It's like driving around the mall at Christmas time, you can't find a parking space, and seeing a lot of traffic versus going to the Indianapolis 500 and seeing cars whipping by. So you know, there's different reasons for there to be a lot of traffic on the road. And so, you know, I mean, I think my sort of advice at this point in 2025 is that if a carnivore or a ketogenic or a low carb diet has clearly improved your quality of life, reversed disease, made you better, but your cholesterol is high, there's a couple options. You can change your diet, which might set you right back to where you were, which might not be desirable, or modify it. Maybe you can bring it down a little bit by adding some carbohydrates and maybe you still get the benefits. That's reasonable. You can take drugs. You know, some people want to do that. Some people don't. Or you can say, hey, look, I'm okay. I'm going to leave my cholesterol high, but I'm going to monitor things. I'm going to get some imaging, look at my heart, maybe a CAC score, maybe a CT angiography or something along those lines, and just see how it plays out. Now, that's 2025. Now, 2028, we may have enough data where we can just say, you know what? You're metabolically healthy, you're lean, ignore cholesterol. I don't know that we're there yet in 2025. I think there's more and more evidence that's getting us there. But again, in trying to be as responsible as I can, I have to say that, you know, this is something that you should take notice of, and then you should just, you know, take catalog of everything else risk factor wise, get some objective data, you know, some sort of, you know, scanning imaging, and then just monitor as time goes by. Again, 3-5 years from now, we might be able to just say, hey, look, you're good. You're good to go. Don't worry about it.
All right. The next one I have is, what about fiber?
Yeah. So fiber is something we're told as a quote unquote essential nutrient. And to me, essentiality requires or means if I don't get it, I'll die. Now, I haven't had any significant fiber in 8 years. I'm still here. I'm doing fine. My brain works. Same without carbohydrates. I'm performing well as an athlete. Fiber is not an essential ingredient. In fact, it is completely indigestible by humans. To think that you have to put something indigestible into your digestive tract to get a benefit is a little bit, doesn't make sense. Now, there's a lot of associative data. And again, we have to remember nutrition science is not a particularly strong science. It's a very weak science in general because we just can't have hard outcomes. We can't lock humans in labs for 50 years and slice them open when we're done and control all the variables. So it's all really this sort of speculative data, and there's associations there that are so incredibly confounded. Fiber is often a marker of better overall diet quality. You know, it's generally the fiber improves outcomes is usually fruits and vegetables, whole foods versus junk food diet. And yeah, the comparison is always going to be better, right? We don't, some of the things that they say that fiber improves outcomes on, maybe you have less glucose excursion, maybe you have better, A1Cs and things like that. Interestingly, and this is something that I said kind of tongue in cheek, is that, you know, I bet I could put sand, I could feed people sand and get the same result. And believe it or not, there have been studies on quote unquote sand silicates, basically engineered silicates that actually lower the A1C, that actually lower the average glucose, that actually improve some of the cardiovascular metrics. So you could just make the same argument. Well, you could just be eating sand, right? But again, this is something we're not designed to eat. If we look at the purpose of our nutrition, why do we eat as a human being? We eat strictly so we can get essential amino acids, essential fats, vitamins, minerals, energy, and then probably water would be an argument. You don't need fiber to get any of that. In fact, fiber inhibits all that. Fiber actually, high fiber diets have been shown to decrease the absorption of protein, to decrease the absorption of fat, to decrease the absorption of even carbohydrates, as well as many vitamins and minerals. So you're actually doing the opposite of nutrition. Now, where it comes in place, when you look at the average American who's, pre-diabetic and 50 pounds overweight, yeah, fiber's preventing you from absorbing nutrition. So you lose weight. So that's a net positive. But if you're on a diet that provides you a decent level of satiety, like carnivore often does, that's providing you very highly bioabsorbable nutrition, the outcomes, in my view, are superior. And so fiber, again, relative to the garbage diet, yeah, it's probably a net benefit. Relative to carnivore, it's probably a net detriment.
You mentioned being an athlete, and that's another argument I get that I didn't have on here. I wanted to ask you about quickly because you've got more experience in this area than I think anyone. I have a lot of people that say, I could never do carnivore. I'm an athlete. I need carbohydrates. Mm. You've been an athlete before you were carnivore. You're still an athlete after carnivore. How has it been for you?
Quick interruption. Did you know we have an incredible membership site for you called healinghumanity.life? We have a special offer going on right now. Learn more at the link in the description. We have courses. We have expert Q&As with the good doctors. We even have a Healing Humanity Heroes Zoom call once a week, highlighting real heroes that will inspire you on a path to healing. The community is wonderful, so you can be held accountable. Recipes, all sorts of great stuff to help you on a path to healing. Learn more at the link in the description below.
Just to be fair, I discovered carnivore when I was just before I turned 50. So I was an old athlete at that time. And as an old athlete, it is incredibly beneficial because I don't have the joint pain. I don't have the aches. My recovery is easier. Not having joint pain and aches and better recovery means I can train more frequently and more intensely. So as an older athlete, I'm kicking ass. I mean, I don't want to brag too much, but I have set world records a number of times now as a carnivore, and particularly in rowing. I can perform at a high level compared to, you know, even guys 20, 30 years younger than me in many ways. We now have examples all across the world, across all sorts of sports, of carnivore athletes that are just killing it. I mean, there's a guy who's just in the Paris Olympics, 400 meter hurdler named CJ Allen. He's basically carnivore, and he's run one of the fastest 400 meter hurdle times of all time as a carnivore. In fact, he barely qualified to try out for the U.S. national team before he was carnivore. He went carnivore. Not only did he make the team, but he went to the Olympics and had one of the best performances of all time in that event. We've got, you know, another guy, Ryan Fulton from Michigan State, who's now on the U.S. decathlon team. Again, full carnivore. I mean, he put up a 10-300 meter dash as a decathlete, which is amazing. I mean, that's smoking fast. It's not 100 meter Olympic champion speed, but it is right close to that. But as a decathlete who has to also shot put and discus and high jump and run the 1500 meters, that's a phenomenal time. Like I said, he's on there. We got Seth Gross, who's on the U.S. wrestling team, another full carnivore, you know, had injuries, went carnivore, made his injuries not hurt anymore, was able to kick butt on that. We've got all kinds of professional rugby players and triathletes and ultra marathon runners doing carnivore. So clearly, and I think the caveat here is you must allow yourself to fully adapt to it, you know, and as an athlete, it might take you 6 months to get fully adapted to it. But once you get there, then it's just a matter of managing, enough fuel and glucose, you know, and glucose comes from eating enough, you know, you have enough protein in your body. You might have to increase your protein a fair bit more than the normal person on carnivore just trying to heal a disease. But certainly you can do that. You know, the work of guys like Phil Primms out of, he's up in Pennsylvania, I can't remember, I'm turning to Grove State College, showing that our assumptions around low-carb diets and glycogen are being shown to be not necessarily true. I mean, this is based on the work came out in 1967 in Finland, or Norway, I think, Norway or Finland. And it has never been challenged because they assumed, it's all about glycogen restoration. Glycogen full. And it's turning out that glycogen in the muscles really doesn't predict performance. It's more blood glucose. And blood glucose, you know, you see guys wearing CGMs now, they're on low-carb diets, and they're in the middle of a grueling event, and their blood glucose is 200-300. Because they can produce that glucose that they need to perform at those high levels. So I think we're seeing, just like we are seeing with health, with the assumptions around health. Oh, well, you don't eat red meat, it's going to give you all these problems, it's going to make you fat and diabetic. But wait a minute, we're giving it to diabetics and it's reversing their diabetes. And not only is it making their blood glucose normalize, it's making their diabetic retinopathy go the other way. It's making their nephropathy go the other way. It's making their blood pressure normalize. And so you can't just say, like the criticism is, oh, well, low-carb diets just mask the symptoms of diabetes. Well, tell me why this guy who had, you know, blood vessel issues in his eyes has reversed that. You know, same thing with the kidneys and so on and so forth. So it's not just masking, it's actually reversing disease. And so we're seeing the same sort of things around some of the athletic stuff. Now, again, a lot of people, you have to have some faith. You have to be willing to give it enough time. You have to try it. You know, and a lot of people, you know, if money's on the line, they're in the middle of the season, they're like, I can't change it right now, because initially there might be a decrease in performance. But once you sort of adapt, I think many people find that their performance is just as good and often better.
I've never exercised, never been an athlete my whole life until carnivore. And now I feel like I just have this excess energy that I have to exercise. My girls and I were doing this 30-day challenge right now. We're watching Dr. Baker's content. We're getting inspired. I was doing the rowing machine actually yesterday. I was thinking about you. Quick question. Do you have any advice on exercising fasted versus after eating? I was arguing with my girls about this, and I really don't know if there's a better.
You know, I mean, it depends on your goals, right? I mean, I think that for general exercise, for 99% of the time, doesn't really matter. You can fast, you can not fast. I think, you know, when it comes to getting your protein, just get it in sometime in the day. I mean, that's what the literature is becoming more and more clear about. You know, you don't have to eat, you know, a bunch of protein and carbs within 30 minutes of a workout. That's all been basically debunked. So as long as you get food in sometimes throughout the day. Now, I will say the only thing that I would say is that if you're going for like an all-out personal best record, then probably having some fuel on board will probably benefit you a little bit. And I think, you know, again, with carnivore, you know, as we know, the way protein is absorbed and the way glucose moves around protein, you're probably going to, you want to eat, you know, 3 or 4 hours prior to a big meet, a big workout. That's the only caveat out there. But for most of it, if you train fasted, don't train fasted, it doesn't matter. Whatever gets you there doing it, you know, and if you got to exercise at 5 o'clock in the morning, cause your job and you don't feel like eating a big meal at 4 o'clock in the morning, go do it fasted, eat later. I mean, there's no major differences there. Now, again, if your job is I'm going to be Mr. Olympia and I'm going to shoot up all the drugs and, you know, yeah, you're going to eat like 5 or 6 times a day. But for most of us, like the vast majority of us, it doesn't matter.
A lot of people have concerns because there's no long-term studies on the carnivore diet. And I've heard some talks, some rumors that you've working on, or you are going to be working on some studies. Do you have any thoughts on that? Or how do you address that concern? Hey, there's no long-term studies on carnivore, therefore I'm not going to do it.
Well, I mean, there's no long-term high quality studies on any diet. I mean, there's retrospective observational studies you can look at, but those are really low quality studies. I mean, we can obviously point to historical. We, you know, there are historical populations which are effectively carnivore. All the circumpolar populations, you know, whether it's the Eskimo, you know, the Inuit, the Nene, the Sami, we've got the Nilotic African tribes, the Dinka, the Maasai. You've got Mongolian, rural Mongolian folks for years. You've got people in South America, the whole Gaucho population in southern Brazil and Argentina. You've got Plains Indians, historical accounts. So we have that. I mean, but again, as far as a high quality randomized controlled trial that's going to last 50 years, not going to happen. What we do have, as you know, we now have obviously tons of anecdotal accounts, which, you know, have some limited value. I'm not, you can't just dismiss them outright because they're anecdotal. We now have case reports, case series have been pushed in the literature now on inflammatory bowel disease, depression, anxiety. We've got anorexia. We've got a couple case reports on various autoimmune conditions. We have another series that's going to be coming out on multiple sclerosis, another one on psoriasis. And then there's interventional trials, which I am behind the scenes working to get done. I'm working with the state of South Dakota, with some of the cattlemen's groups in South Dakota. I'll be in Oklahoma working with some groups. These are cattle states that it makes sense for them to say, hey, look, this makes sense to fund these studies. Also, Rivero is collecting data on our patients that do carnivore, some form of carnivore, and we'll be publishing our data. So they're, and of course, as we all know, that David Ludwig in 2021 published that study out of Harvard on 2,063 carnivores or 2,069 carnivores, I think. So we have more and more data coming out there. I mean, there was a, you know, it's interesting there, and we're seeing the pushback now because people are dismissing the case reports and yet they're publishing their own case reports. There was just a recent study published by a cardiologist said, oh, I saw a carnivore who had xanthelasma, which is, you know, yellowing of the, often around the eyes or the skin, and it's associated with high cholesterol. And he said, we had a carnivore guy, he had this, and his cholesterol, his total cholesterol was 1,000 milligrams, so it was pretty damn high, right? I mean, even among carnivore, that's quite high. But the interesting thing is, even though you have that yellow deposits in your skin, the data out there indicates that that does not increase your risk for heart disease, even with that really, 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 I mean, at least that association directly. Now, some people would argue, well, the cholesterol is high, and that's a risk factor. And then we can go back to this whole lipid energy model, lean mass hyperresponder type of thing. But yeah, we're getting more and more data in the literature on that. We're never going to have a long-term RCT. I don't think, because that's never happened for any diet. I mean, it's just, so all you're going to have is observational associations, and then you're going to have these short to medium term things. What I'm hoping to say, and what I'll say over and over again, if your doctor is telling you he can predict the future, you know, what you're going to die of or how long you're going to live, he's lying to you, right? What your doctor should be saying and why you go to the doctor is, I'm sick and I don't want to be sick anymore, right? That's the point. And I am very confident that in many cases, you can put somebody on a carnivore diet or similar to a very close carnivore diet. You can make people that are sick healthier, as you see, as we all see over and over again. So I think that's where our focus should be, taking sick people, not making them sick anymore, and stop worrying about making them live forever or pretending we know what's going to prevent these diseases, because we really don't. At least from a nutritional standpoint, I should put that caveat out there. If someone's diabetic, yes, they're more likely to have heart disease. But if they're but saying diet by itself, because, you know, first of all the data we have out there, all that food frequency questionnaire data is complete, almost complete garbage. I mean, there was a recent study on doubly labeled water that showed that basically when they actually measure how much energy people expend versus what they think they use or eat, it's like off by 50%. Mm. So it means it's like, that's how bad that data is. It's 50% of it's wrong.
Those food frequency questionnaires are insane. I do carnivore. I eat like three things. I still couldn't even tell you what I ate last week on carnivore. A burger or steak? I don't even know. Let alone when I was eating the standard American diet. It's insane to me.
No, I mean, you know, you could say, I mean, how much red meat did you eat? And I could say I eat that every day.
Yeah.
You know, I could tell you that. But I mean, as far as, you know, how many eggs I ate last year, I don't know. I had some. I couldn't tell you exactly.
Right. If carnivore is so good, then why are all the blue zones plant-based?
Well, I mean, it depends how you define a blue zone. You know, first of all, Dan Butner, who did that research, he's a Seventh-day Adventist, obviously very biased in this sort of stuff. He's attached to Loma Linda University, I believe. And, you know, one of the things is that there was a really nice evaluation of that blue zones data. And there was I forget the guy's name. He published a paper on this a few years back. And he showed that those blue zones are basically filled with fraudulent data. I mean, all these countries where they say that these people are living, these super centenarians living 110, none of them have birth certificates. And in fact, everywhere where birth certificates has been instated, the number of people over 100 shrinks by 80% because most of them are committing fraud. Because you think about it, if you live in a society where you can retire at 65 or 70 or 62 or whatever it is, it behooves you to sort of lie. If you're like 55, you're like, I don't feel like working anymore. I'm going to say I'm 65, right? That happens all the time, right? It's just that if you don't have good record keeping or a good way to do that, you see that's there. The other thing about blue zones, like for instance, you can go to like Okinawa, which is considered one of them. And they did a survey back in 1949 where they got most of their data. And they said, oh, they're living all these sweet potatoes. But, you know, right before what 1949, as most of us would hopefully remember, was World War II, where Okinawa was literally destroyed. And all their pigs, and they had hundreds of thousands of pigs on the island, were gone. They were wiped out. I think they had a few hundred left. It was so bad that people from Hawaii, former Japanese people in Hawaii, brought all these pigs back to Okinawa in the 1950s and 60s to get them back to where they were. The same thing, you know, back in, I think it was in Crete, they came during some fasting holiday to observe them. And it was like, yeah, they weren't eating meat because they were basically fasting, or they were on this religious holiday where they were abstaining from that. The other thing is there are so many counterexamples of people eating lots and lots of meat, living super long. I mean, Hong Kong, I've talked about many, many times, highest life expectancy in the world, highest IQ in the world, highest meat consumption in the world. You've got places like Iceland where men have one of the highest rates of living over 100 in the world, and they eat very little fruits and vegetables. Because why? I mean, where is Iceland? It's a frozen rock sitting at the very edge of the North Atlantic Ocean, just before the Arctic Sea. There ain't no fruits and vegetables growing up there, guys. There's barely any grain. The only grain they get is imported from Denmark, and that comes to feed their livestock. So when I went to visit Iceland telling people about carnivore diet, they looked at me like, yeah, of course. You know, all we got up here is some sheep, you know, a few goats, a few cows, and some fish. What else are we going to eat, right? So, you know, I mean, that stuff, again, is very much kind of a propagandized thing that's been pushed by, again, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the Adventist Health System, Dan Butner, who's a product of that. And it's been monetized because, again, plants are cheaper to sell. It's more lucrative, and you make more money selling highly refined plant food than you do animal products. So anyway, I think it's a lot of it's about profit.
Thank you so much for watching. If you're interested in learning more about our documentary, Healing Humanity, The Power of a Proper Human Diet, or supporting it, please visit donate.healinghumanity.movie. Our goal is to reach millions of people that are hopeless right now, and sharing the examples of real people over the course of 1 year that are undertaking a proper human diet to overcome obesity, type 2 diabetes, depression, anxiety, fertility issues. We couldn't do it without you. We thank you so much. We are also selling these shirts, Healing Humanity, The Power of a Proper Human Diet. Every penny we get from those goes towards the documentary. And last, we have memberships. If you click the little join button, it's best to do it on desktop. Under any one of my YouTube videos, you can join and become a member. We have hundreds of members right now. We do members-only videos. We do members-only behind the scenes. You can email me as a member and I'll answer you. And every penny from that goes to support the documentary. And the last thing is, we have these Redmond's portable salt shakers. These things are awesome. You can get the best salt. You can take it with you. We sell these on the website along with our water bottles and cutting boards, and every penny from all of those goes 100% towards supporting the documentary. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which is completely free. All of these links are in the description below.